It's Primus Drax with Josh, Frankie, and Sawyer.
What a couple of dumps. Hello, primates! You found Primus Drax. Congratulations. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Primus Drax. You can email us at primustraxpod@gmail.com. We also have a brand spanking new Facebook page. I think you just search for Primus Drax and you'll find it. The guy I'm about to bring in can tell you more about it. It's Frankie Beristein.
Mr. Bald?
I don't know about this Mr. Bald thing, but I guess we'll keep it going. The reason you're
Should I stick with the classic hi, Josh?
You follow your heart, buddy. You do what you think is right. The reason you're not hearing a second person say hello to Mr. Bald and ask about my balls is because Tim Sawyer is actually not here today. He is helping Tim Alexander get his kit ready for the Tribute to Kings tour. So, excused absence. Herb, if you want to dial in and confirm, sounds great. Sawyer won't get in trouble. But we are joined by a bass expert. You've heard his voice on this podcast before. You've seen some of his videos that help follow up on some of our bass talk at Ham of Truth 86 on Instagram. Welcome back to Primus Drax, Matt Hunter. Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Frankie. Hey, Josh. How you doing?
Well, first of all, I noticed that Frankie said, hi, Matt, and not Mr. Hunter. So clearly I am held in highest of regards over there at Primus Drax Towers in Mexico City. Thanks, Frankie. You're making me feel real good. Today we're talking about Chastising of Renegade. It is the penultimate track to the Brown album. We are so close to the end, folks. Matt, when we were talking about which tracks to address on the Brown album, you had it narrowed down, I believe, to Kalamazoo and Renegade. So I'm curious, just in general, Renegade in particular, what draws you to this track?
Renegade, it's tucked all the way at the back, and it's kind of easy to forget that it's there. But I distinctly remember a few years ago listening to it and just being absolutely blown away by Lur's solo.
Ah.
I think it's one of Lur's best solos, or at least perhaps my favorite Lur solo. There's a lot going on, and he's given a lot of sort of space to play with. But I don't have the Lur guitar knowledge to sort of deconstruct and explain that. So I'm here on the bass to talk about Les's thing, and it's sort of like a lot of the other tracks we've been talking about on the Brown album, where it's a bit understated, but between Les and Brain, there's just kind of this moody kind of vibe that's just kind of plods along. I think the Renegade refrain perhaps sticks around a few more times at the end than I might prefer, but the track overall, like, it's got this really chunky riff in it too that, like, is played in unison with Larry, which isn't something that happens super often. Right. I mean, you hear it here and there where Larry sort of matches the riff that Les is doing. Like, he does it in Beef. Right. And I guess to an extent in things like 11 or things like that. But this is a particularly, like, dark, chunky sounding riff, and I think it's a really cool one in the Primus catalog, for sure.
Right on. Well, you'll be able to help us then build the foundation, the backbone of this track, and then we can all, of course, bask in the bright suns, plural, of Lurland. So we'll be able to appreciate that. We do have some business to take care of at the outset, as we normally do. We do have a piece of miscellaneous debris from our Coddingtown episode, where Sawyer couldn't remember, or none of us could remember, the names of Les's dogs. There was Corn Dog, and then good old Daryl, thanks Daryl, who remembers everything, he correctly identified Capone as the other dog that they had at the time. Kazooa is a more recent addition to the family.
Kazooa's a new one, yeah.
Yeah, and that album's like 13 years old, so Kazoo might not be around anymore, man. But Corn and Capone were the two dogs that he had back in the 90s.
Is it my turn for the debris?
You're up.
Okay, guys, so thanks a lot to Julian for pointing out that there is a recording of the KROQ Almost Acoustic Christmas. Because the setlist is so short, I somehow remember that maybe the recording was not complete, but it is complete. The thing is that Disco Jam is pretty long, and that's where, you know, they went all out.
Oh, also, right, the Disco Jam. That was about a 9-minute medley of just goofy stuff. And
yeah, that's
Adam
where all hell breaks loose. Yeah.
Yes, Adam was doing his best coked out singer impersonation and doing a beautiful job at it.
Also, thanks a lot to the person who sent us the Camelback Cinema cover. Unfortunately, it's too late now to play it, but we do appreciate being aware of this recording.
So, really cool stuff. Keep sending those links our way. Frankie loves looking at them.
Also,
I love ignoring
also
them.
Thanks. Yeah, totally. Also, thanks to Nick for effectively confirming that our Dutch pronunciation was correct for, you know, the songs on Rest in Bones episode.
I would just like to point out that Frankie likes to point out when he's right. That's what I get from this, and I think it's very important that you do that.
And finally, thanks a lot to Jesse for enjoying the factoids. He has a meeting, you know, once a week where somebody shares a fun fact, and apparently, you know, the bone facts and the camel facts have been pretty good for him at these meetings. So, yeah, we'll keep them coming.
This guy's recycling your material at his work meetings?
Yeah.
And he still has a job. That's impressive. All right. Good luck, Jesse. Wow.
I was trying desperately to think of a funny spin on Camel Fact Mania for the Rest in Bones, and I just could not do it, but I love it too.
I would have just said, that's why I'm researching bones. That would have been mine, but that just comes to mind now. All right, next thing is our Captain Shiner's Yacht. We have a couple of wonderful people that have gained admission to Captain Shiner's Yacht. You too can do the same. All you have to do is send us a DM on Instagram or email us at primustrekspod@gmail.com. That doubles as our PayPal email address. You send us a few bucks, I'll send you some beautiful Primus Treks stickers designed by Frankie and printed by the wonderful people over at Sticker Robot. I still have a few hundred stickers here, guys. I made a huge order. Please don't make me regret that terrible mistake. Today's entrance onto Captain Shiner's Yacht are Mickey in Louisiana and Jared in Virginia. Thank you both for your generous donations. You've got stickers coming your way. I will mention, Jared, there was a green Naugahyde vinyl listed on eBay. I bought it for quite a reasonable price. This is one of the coolest things that's ever happened to me, Frankie. I messaged the seller and said, thanks for being upfront about the condition of the record. And they messaged back and said, yeah, I want to be honest about it. It'll look great if you put it up on the wall. And if you haven't heard of this podcast, it's called Primus Tracks. So if you're a big Primus fan, check it out. And I messaged back and I said, well, thanks for promoting that thing. I just happened to host it.
What did the seller respond to that?
Something like, holy crap, I didn't know it was you. And how would they? My eBay username has nothing to do with Primus. So there you go. So that was that brightened my day. Good times.
Nothing like a good chat with an eBay seller. I quite enjoy those.
Especially when they promote your podcast for you. It's really nice. I didn't have to do a thing.
I recall a similar experience that you had at a hardware store, I believe, where someone was trying to do small talk with you because of your Primus shirt, but you refused to reveal that you were behind Primus Tracks, right?
This is true. They complimented my Primus shirt, and I said, thanks, they're a great band. My wife, as we walked out, said, why didn't you tell me you had a podcast? I said, I didn't want to get into that. Also, I didn't have any stickers on me, so how could I hand him a, you know, he wouldn't have believed me. So there's that. Matt, I'm sure this happens to you all the time. They say, hey, it's that gear dude. He knows things.
I can't even leave the house without, you know, the paparazzi blowing me up. So I'm a recluse. I stay in my hole and I read Carl Thompson's website all day.
avoiding TMZ.
Well, we should talk about the chastising of Renegade. Frankie.
Yeah.
It's your favorite part.
Really brief live history. Chastising of Renegade was only performed 10 times in total in Primus history so far. And interestingly enough, 8 out of those 10 times were in Europe and only 2 times in the United States. Curiously enough, the last performance to date of Renegade took place on New Year's Eve 1998.
Almost all those performances then were limited to the year 1998, correct?
That's right. And the European leg.
There are a few recordings. Frankie was kind enough to bring a couple of live cuts today, and we'll get to those in a bit. The track itself, wow, not a lot of live cuts. We're going to have to really delve into the track itself then. And Matt, I'm so glad you're here to talk about this. And, you know, I'm going to echo some things you said earlier, but to me, this is one of the more complete and engaging tracks on the Brown album. And it's really interesting that they saved it for track 14, really buried in the back near the end. So, a couple of things, Matt. I'm curious about why you think they put it at the end. And Soya's not here, unfortunately, to reveal to us or to help us with, was this one that came about from the drum beat or the bass line? Was this one they jammed out before going up to Rancho Relaxo? But it's definitely one that they worked on without feeling or having the overworked, I would say, quality of Bob's Party Time. So, your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess you could start out with saying, you know, to echo some of the stuff Soy has been saying, there's an A, a B, and a C part in this song, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So that, I mean, that already sort of brings it a little bit more complexity than maybe a few of the songs leading up to this point in the record. As to why they maybe tucked it in the back, I don't know. It's kind of, the Brown album is, it's a pretty long record. And I think some of the tracks certainly could have fit in a different arrangement, because there are sort of the tracks that jump out at you more as sort of more straightforward or up-tempo or single material. And then there's other stuff that kind of occupies a different mood or a different kind of space in terms of the journey of the record. And Renegade, I feel like it could have fit at other points in the record, but at the same time, I've heard it this way for so many years, and it does kind of make sense as a segue into Arnie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we'll have to come back to Arnie as well. I don't want to forget to mention Arnie. But yeah, this song is, it's kind of, it is maybe a little more structurally interesting than some of the other songs towards this latter portion of the record. And it's just got a cool vibe, like I said, and a chunky riff. So who could ask for more?
Yeah. You know, one thing that Les had talked about, especially around the Goblins album, Rainbow Goblins album, the Desaturating Seven, call it whatever you want, he had harkened back to all the wonderful prog albums that he listened to as a kid in the 70s and into the 80s even. And he said, you know, all those albums were only about 34 minutes long. He purposefully wrote a shorter record for the Goblins. And I'm curious, you know, if we used that same idea and went back to the Brown album, we don't have to do it right now, but if we were going to cut the Brown album down to about 38 minutes,
oh wow,
you know, I wonder what the approach would be and what they would have left on the cutting room floor to get that album down to something like that. Because it is a long album. It's almost an hour, which is really long. And a lot of people talk about, by expanding the capacity of media, CDs being 79 and change, that the compulsion is to fill it. Just like when I moved into this giant house I'm in, I felt like I had to fill the space. So I started buying all this shit. That's why I have Primus posters all over the walls, these cavernous rooms. They just felt empty. That, I know that's part of it. I really do wonder if we were going to do that exercise, what would happen? Not that we have to today, maybe next time.
I do wish, Josh, I do wish Primus had been, I don't want to say forced, but maybe encouraged by the record label to release more commercial singles, because they have a lot of promotional singles, but they have very, very few commercial singles that were actually in circulation at the record stores. And I believe that if they had been compelled to release more of those, they would have had to record more material. You know, if you look at the catalog of a lot of artists and bands from years ago, they have very long lists of B-sides and non-album tracks. And that's because they had to record that kind of stuff to fill up singles.
I think there was a changing landscape by the 90s, but I think you're absolutely right. I remember reading in the Grapevine book that Primus was not, when I say Primus, I mean Les, was not very interested in recording things on the side for use on compilations or promotional materials. He just wanted to record the record and put it out there and go support the record. And I know that was always a point of contention, probably with the label and management and that sort of thing. Because I remember Lefkowitz in the book said, you know, if you don't show interest in them, they're not going to show any more interest in you. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the idea. You know, they're not going to promote you anymore if you won't go out and play the game or sail the seas of cheese, as it were. So I think we're seeing that happening, you know, after Punch Bowl.
I think both of you are pretty spot on with your assessment in this. It's interesting looking through the course of, you know, sort of the last several decades of music, going back to, like Frankie saying, the 50s and 60s, you see a lot more sort of, you might have a record here or there, but there's a lot of singles, and then singles get compiled into like marketable records that they can sell as like a greatest hits or like a, you know, whatever. And then it's really when you get into the 70s that you start seeing the album, I think, emerge as a really important format, especially as prog sort of adopts it as like it's more about the album than the individual songs and things like that. But you're right, Josh. By the time you get to the 90s, there was definitely in the mid to late 90s, there was this sense that bands had to fill the whole medium in order to sort of almost, I don't know if it was to justify the format or just to kind of stretch the boundaries of, you know, what could typically be thought of as a record. If you look at something like The Wall, I mean, you only need to trim a few minutes off of The Wall to turn it from a double LP into a single CD.
Yeah.
So it really changes the way you think about a record. And, you know, there were certainly, you know, Metallica's Load was as much space as would fit on a CD. And I remember having Lateralis by Tool is almost also like exactly how much space you can fit on a CD. Uh-huh. And I do, you know, growing up a metal kid of sort of a fan of the 80s kind of metal thing where there was a lot more cassettes and vinyl. I am more of an all killer, no filler kind of guy. If you can cram all the best material into one straight listening experience, I think that's much more effective than throwing in everything that you got. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, especially when you reference Load. So there's, yeah, it's, yeah. And, you know, but unless you're a Metallica or an Iron Maiden and selling CD singles by the hundreds of thousands, you're not going to record those B-sides. And those guys, I think they knew that what they had, so they did it so they could release all these singles with goofy B-sides, even if they were just live cuts or demos, they held on to that stuff to put that out there, or weird covers, yes. You know?
You know, that reminds me of the Manic Street Preachers. Every time they put out a new album, they offer different configurations, and there's usually a deluxe edition which includes all songs from the new album in demo format. So they don't even hold back on that stuff for later reissues. I mean, they offer it straight up. I mean, you can hear the new album and the demos at the same time. In contrast, I mean, we salivated when Chaney posted those images of the reels she discovered in storage, because we don't have access to this kind of material from Primus. It's a mystery to us.
I think the mystery is fueling you, Frankie. I think once the mystery is solved, you'll just fall over satisfied and I'll never see you again. So part of me hopes the mystery carries on. Well, let's talk about the track. We kind of got off on a sidebar there, but it was an important one as far as content goes. You know, you talked about an A, B, and C part, Matt. I think I would argue that there's four parts. You've got your A part with the main lick that starts the tune. The B part is our verse with some variations in there even. So there's like a B sub one and a B sub two. And then I would say the C part is that really cool unison riff that you mentioned. And then our D part, yeah, I would say, is
my favorite part
is Larry's solo. So I know you got that.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know what it is, but it is much more dynamic in presentation. Although, and maybe you can burst this bubble for me, it feels like none of it is too complicated musically when I look at just the guitar part, just the bass part, just the drums. Now, these guys are doing things I can't do as a layman. Mm. But they're. I don't think they're doing anything too crazy. But to me, this is a track that is the sum of its parts, you know, or as they say, greater than the sum of its parts, because it all comes together beautifully to me.
I think there are definitely other parts of the record where you can point to where, like, oh man, Les is going crazy here, or Brain is really bringing it. I think the real star of this track, as I said, really just for the solo, is Lur. But for a lot of the track, Lur is also skanking or just playing a unison riff,
yeah,
or just kind of playing counterpoint to that kind of A part where Les is kind of, you know, percussively playing that. I think it's a seventh chord. So yeah, there's nothing super crazy musically going on, but it is sort of a sum of its parts kind of thing where all of that comes together to create an interesting progression and, just like I said, a cool vibe and a chunky riff.
Let's take a little tour of some of these parts. So how about I'll play a chunk of the A part and maybe you can talk us through what's going on here. Okay, so my first observation is that the drums and bass are locked in. And that's, to me, I'm thinking, wow, this is like Tim Alexander and Les, when the way that those guys just got locked in.
as usual, you know, Les and whichever drummer he's working with, they lock in really different, dynamic, interesting ways. And the way that Les locks in with Brain is really, really cool and really special. But Lur is playing sort of, Les is playing a fairly simple, straightforward kind of bass riff where it's largely based around that seventh chord that was mentioned in like Golden Boy and Groundhog's Day and sort of all over the place in Les's repertoire, where I believe it's a B7. And so, and rhythmically, he's just kind of lingering before he gets into the second time around, just to make some weird kind of push and pull. Uh-huh. And then it kind of ends with just kind of a descending kind of run there. And every once in a while, he'll throw in a little flurry on the lower notes, kind of hinting at the notes that are going to come in more in the B part, kind of the verse. But Lur is playing this really sort of, he's never in unison with Les, but yeah, what he's playing is sort of like bouncing back and forth between what Les is playing in, I think, a really cool way.
Yeah, this is textbook Larry Lalonde of filling the spaces. He always says that. Find the spaces, find the little pockets, and he's finding them all over it, all over this one. And it sounds really, really off kilter, and it could be off putting, but it's really great because we have Brain providing a really solid, ballsy drum beat underneath all of this.
What do you guys think about this idea? So the Cretin said, the cool thing about Chastising the Renegade is that the bass line, along with Lur's guitar work, sounds like an amalgamation of annoying sounds a menace of a neighborhood kid would make. Random door knocks, jumping on a trampoline, and flying his remote-controlled airplane around neighbors' houses.
There's an interpretation. That's the beauty of music. It could. You could certainly make that riff on repeat, the soundtrack to a Dennis the Menace episode. And you wouldn't miss a beat, I think. So that guy might be onto something there. Let's go to the B part, because I'm really curious about the bass line there, Matt. There's a lot going on, and it does kind of sound unusual. So once again, drums and bass locked in. Brain doing some really cool stuff on the hi-hat, Tim Alexander doesn't always do. So there's kind of that return, and I'm sure Les loved that because his bass pattern is matching that hi-hat work. So I don't know which one came first, but they're locking in.
This is sort of a classic example of how Les always describes himself like as a very percussive player. Like, he loves the drums because it's such a percussive instrument, obviously, but ostensibly, I mean, it's a fairly, as far as the notes and the content, it's fairly straightforward and fairly simple, but it's all of the rhythmic accents that he puts on top of it that makes it into something really cool, I think. So what you're dealing with is you're on G for the first part of the riff, and he's playing an octave from, you know, the G on the low E string to just an open G string to more towards the top here. We are on the sixth string bass because there's some cool low stuff happening too. But so there's that octave there, and he's taking it a half step up for some tension and release.
Oh yeah.
And throwing in some percussive nature in there, and then he does some more, you know, just pops and slaps, nothing, no notes necessarily, and then the return of the tritone. We all love the tritone. Here it comes once again.
Yes.
Coming back into the riff. So
all hail the tritone.
And that's most of it. Every once in a while, he'll coming away from the B into that tritone, which is either a D flat or a C sharp, depending on your preference. He'll kind of come up to the D and do an octave there as well. So it's kind of, during that B part, and Larry's just skanking behind it. And that with, like you said, Brain's hi-hat work and pretty sparse drumming otherwise, just kind of keeping the beat on the bass drum. It just makes for a really cool vibe, I think.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about that percussive part?
Are you
doing a lot of plucking there, or with the thumb, or finger picking there?
So this is really interesting, actually. When you sort of hear a lot of the less percussive, when he's really doing a whole lot of, you're talking a lot about what you hear in Tommy the Cat, or what you hear later in Lacquerhead during that bass break. It's a lot of there's a slap with the right thumb. There's kind of a percussion on the neck of the instrument with your fretting finger, and then there's a pluck with your right hand. So you're kind of stringing all those things together usually when it comes to doing these kind of interesting rhythmic things that Les does. But something around the Brown album that he started doing more was trying to almost sort of like how guitarists will sometimes try to down pick a riff more instead of alternate picking. Les was doing a lot of just slapping several times with his right thumb and then occasionally plucking with his right hand and not doing as much of the fretting hand kind of percussion over here. So like, for example, if you watch Videoplasty when he does Kalamazoo, during that kind of break in the middle of the song where he does the and then goes back into the riff, that's like all slap, slap, pop, slap, slap, pop, as opposed to the other thing that I was just describing, which in, I know this isn't the Kalamazoo episode, but in later years when he kind of does the extended bit of that, like in the Jay Lane era, he's more doing his normal, that kind of thing. So it was just something he was doing at this time, seems a little more than otherwise, but it's usually some mix of that, and it's there's no notes, so you can kind of, I think, get away with doing it however you prefer, really. Whatever comes easiest to you. I tend to kind of go more the route of how he plays the Tommy the Cat break and the Lacquerhead break and things like that, where it's a combination of all three of those things.
It does seem like he was trying a lot of different things during the Brown album, including just wearing out that fretted six that everybody's favorite. It sounds fantastic.
Josh, can you play the track at 2 minutes to hear my favorite part?
2 minutes flat? Let's see. Is this the C part? We're getting into the C part. Yeah. The unison riff. Ah, yes.
I was waiting for it.
That's a nice little transition out of it, too, with the slide. So what's
the slide
going on
was
there?
Thick
slide,
thick.
Yes.
Very thick. It's broadly in the shape of a power chord, kind of the notes that he's climbing up to. And he's climbing up to them in a very sort of chromatic way, but also throwing in some of that tritone right at the beginning, sort of in a... nice and ugly tritone there. And it starts on the, again, the D flat or C sharp, depending on your preference. And it just kind of climbs up from there and gets to the octave and climbs up a bit more. It's very, I'm not as perhaps musically educated as a few other of our esteemed guests on the podcast who could probably explain it a bit more eloquently, but it's, you're basically taking that, you're taking that D flat and coming up to the G sharp and then coming up to the next string to a C sharp. And it just kind of doing a chromatic ascending lick on those two strings and then landing right back where you started. Looking at it from sort of a guitarist perspective, because I am primarily a guitar player, it's a very almost kind of blues box kind of riff, but with some ugly tritone in there, which is what a lot of old, like, Sabbath-y kind of metal is. And there was, speaking of 90s, as we're talking a lot about the 90s today, there was a distinct moment in the 90s, I think probably because of Ozzfest, when Sabbath became like a big part of the cultural, the music conversation at that time, where everyone was like, oh yeah, remember how great Aussie era Sabbath was? And there were like a couple tribute records, and Primus did NIB,
right,
and all this stuff. I have to feel like this riff is maybe a bit informed by that kind of an influence. Just based on the notes involved, and you know, because that tritone is the Black Sabbath kind of interval, the
right,
you know, that kind of thing. So
right, I think if you slowed it down a few BPM, had more of a straight ahead rock drumming line behind it, it might sound like a Sabbath song almost.
Yeah, it's still got that bouncy kind of funky Primus thing to it too, so it's always going to be a bit more, you know, up tempo and energetic than yeah, maybe an old doomy kind of Sabbath dirge, but it's definitely working in the same sort of vocabulary, I would say.
Well, let's take a look at the D part, because this is where things yes, really get interesting. So we're going to play a little bit of the D part here that leads into Larry's extended solo to end the track. Actually, I'm going to pause and go back, because I think my new obsession, my new Primus obsession, brand spanking new, after talking about it during the Kalamazoo episode, is I want to go back and hear how Larry introduces himself with all of the solos. Because just the transition, you know, the rip from Kalamazoo is just killer, but there's a really great one here too, where he just announces his arrival in this wacky way. So I'm going to actually play a little bit of that one more time for everybody's pleasure, mostly my own. That's a killer transition. I have to stop now, otherwise I'm just going to play the whole thing and we're going to sit here and listen to it together. Larry's doing this thing. Brain opens it up for the ride cymbal, so we're going places with it. He's just thumping along on this thing. He's really taking a back seat now.
When it comes to Lur solos, I think we're seeing a level of melodicism, or at least more traditional melodicism, in kind of the Brown era than we are maybe seeing up to this point. And maybe that has to do with them kind of very deliberately going for a kind of a retro vibe and doing all the Led Zeppelin recording techniques and things like that. But there's a lot more kind of blues box stuff happening, even in Larry's guitar solos. And, you know, I'm an unabashed, you know, metal dude. Metal is basically blues and classical music, and then add a whole lot of distortion for the most part.
Can't be bad. And
yeah, for sure. And just that, the Lur solo in this song is just, it, the way it builds, especially the way it starts and kind of leads into that D part. Yeah, Les is just chunking along on that root note of the riff that we were talking about, where, and just leaving the space wide open otherwise,
yeah,
for basically Larry to carry the whole thing home. And I think it's awesome.
He's doing that syncopated 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, which is great, mm-hmm, because it makes it a little more funky, of course, than just a straight ahead bop, 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 bop while Larry does his thing. And I would say that Lur solo, I mean, I don't think we fully go to Lur land. I think we're on the outskirts of it, because this is more of a straight ahead. Like you said, it's kind of that blues box thing, but it's a straight ahead guitar solo.
Yeah, and I'm not the greatest Deadhead Jerry Garcia aficionado, but I feel like there's, like, a lot of the things I hear in the second half of the Winona solo, for instance, where there's a lot more sort of maybe traditional melody happening and a little less kind of dissonance and tritone happening.
Yeah.
And with all the space that he's given and the vibe that the song has given you up to that point, he's just given a lot of space to explore. And I really like what he does with it, especially that part. I can't even really describe it, but where it's like, towards the beginning of the solo.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
That part is just so cool. There's all these little parts in the solo that I really, really love. And the way that it all flows together, I think, is really, really cohesive as well.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that part, and I didn't even play that he's giving us some runs over the C part. And then mm-hmm, we get that transition to the D part where Les sits on the root note. So he does do some cool stuff over that C part as well. It's an extended showcase for Larry. And this ultimately is Les taking the back seat and going, Larry, do your thing. And he has a minute and a half, really, to cover. That's a long time. That is, like, that's an eternity, I think, for a guitar player sometimes, it would seem.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it even feels like the kind of track that could have ended the album, in a way, because it's just such a, like, it's a pretty understated track overall, but then you get kind of a killer riff, and you just get this huge, huge rad guitar solo to kind of ride you all the way out. And I think they end the track sort of perfectly. I think the momentum and the pace of the solo is just about perfect in my book. And where it ends could have been a nice bookend for the record, but of course Arnie pops back up, and Arnie is pretty cool too. And no record of theirs has ended. I'm not trying to get ahead of the, you know, episode to Arnie, but no other Primus record has really ended that way when Arnie comes on either. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, you're right. I think this one, Renegade, is punctuated brilliantly at the end. You know, I'll play it for us to listen to, but it's that ba 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 ba, that, and Larry ends with it too. So they all end in unison, and a unison ending, not common with a Primus tune, but hearing it, super duper satisfying. That's how you do it. A lot of great parts here. Our B variations on the verse, where Les actually sings a little bit. He didn't seem to mind a bit. I was flat on that last note, sorry. But he's actually going along with, he's changing the bass line a little bit, and he's singing along with it. So we even get that B sub 2 there, I guess I would call it. But yeah, there's a lot going on with this one. And it doesn't have it just doesn't have those harsh changes like Bob's Party Time does with that abrupt transition. This just seems a little more organic, even though they definitely worked on this one, but maybe it flowed a little bit better.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean, as opposed to in the middle of Bob's, where before you get into that cool.
Yeah.
And the song just kind of stops and then picks up somewhere where, like, it kind of works, but there's none of that sort of like, okay, here's a lull and we're going to go into this next part now.
Right.
All the parts kind of flow pretty seamlessly into each other in this tune, I would say, for having multiple parts as opposed to just an A or an A and a B part.
Right. Yeah. This one pretty darn satisfying in that regard.
Oh, just before we dive into the lyrics, Josh, I just wanted to add that Renegade is my favorite track on the album, along with Beef, and it's probably one of my all-time favorite Lur guitar solos. It's just incredible.
You heard it here first, folks. Your Frankie's forming his list. Be ready. Get your notebooks out.
I feel that the solo really adds a lot to the song. I mean, there are perhaps other tracks where it seems like, you know, the solo is just some crazy improvisation that happened at the moment. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it's weird. But in this case, I feel like
always
the
weird.
Solo is integral to the song. I mean, I cannot picture this song without that solo. I mean, it's just part of its DNA.
That's a great point. Yes, it feels like it belongs. It's not out of left field. And it certainly matches the mood, which is kind of a menacing mood. I think you were using that word at some point, Frankie, and I wonder if it carries over to the lyrics for you.
Regarding the lyrics, Josh, it seems like, you know, Les was once again, you know, applying this literary resource that he carried throughout the Brown album, where he tells us about characters. We don't get to know a lot about them through the lyrics at all. Sometimes we don't even have their names. Just, you know, very general descriptions that hint at something either dark or tragic. In the case of Renegade, at first glance, you know, the song could give you the impression that is, you know, it's just this mischievous kid around the block, you know, maybe just pulling pranks like any boy of a similar age would do. But I mean, as the song carries on and you start hearing the kind of things that he's doing, you kind of wonder, you know, if at one point it's going to culminate into, you know, something devastating for other people. You know, besides setting the place on fire, you know, I'm talking about other kind of things, you know, escalating.
Well,
interesting. Arnie's thrown in there.
Arnie Schell gets a tow truck through.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, the Shell, I mean, obviously the Shell, right? Because they used to hang out at Elsa Brandy Shell. Yeah. So the Shell station's going to get some love. That name pops up a few times on the record.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't this our second mention of Arnie on the record so far?
Yep. We had
it is.
We had Arnie and Duchess. We have Arnie and Renegade. Mm. And then we have a track with that name. Although, interestingly, the name is not uttered within that track. So that's me hitting my microphone. So I don't know where we land with Arnie.
Zoya was supposed to elucidate the great mystery of Arnie for us.
Perhaps next week, folks.
Next week.
I hope so. I'm waiting with bated breath.
Yes. Well, you know, I hope he only reveals half of it so Frankie is still interested. Because if he tells it all, Frankie will just package it up and walk away into the sunset.
There is one thing I really like about the lyrics, Josh.
Yep.
They don't seem modern at all. And Liz doesn't even have to, you know, he doesn't have to struggle a lot with the imagery or the descriptions. I mean, just by mentioning these places, yes, you know, and not even going into a lot of detail about them, I totally picture something vintage. You know, it absolutely fits the essence of the album.
I agree 1,000%. I mean, just the name Renegade, that's an older term. Mm-hmm. You still hear it, yeah, but it's an older term. But all the other terminology he's used throughout this entire record almost screams 1897 to me. And I've said it 1,000 times already, but that's why I made that connection, because this does sound like antiquated language. And to that point, Frankie, you talked about this is going to culminate in something bad for someone. Well, it does. Renegade's going to get beaten by his dad. That's like, that's the whole thing. His dad's like, I've had enough. You're not shaping up. Come here, boy. And he's going to beat him, thrash him. He's going to hurt him. So that's where it's going and careening towards, unfortunately. But I do want to point out linguistically, Frankie, or sorry, the modern definition of to chastise is to severely reprimand somebody, usually verbally or through some kind of written thing. But there's an older definition that we don't use anymore. To chastise somebody meant to physically beat them. And so that's where this is going. So when you hear the title, The Chastising of Renegade, for the longest time, I just thought, oh, his dad's going to yell at him. But then when you listen to those unprinted lyrics that Les drops in there with the dad, you know, Renegade done about all I can. So that phrase, come take your medicine like a man, dad's taken off the belt. We'll say that. There's some beatings going on. Takes me right back to Catholic school. God, I really wish those chants were printed in the lyric book, though. I can make out some of them, but not all of them. But they're great because it's just the lamentations of this father who can't control his son or get his son to listen or something like that. But I love the choice of the name Renegade for a kid. It actually reminded me, in my first couple of years of teaching, I had a student named Blade. And I thought, please don't stab me. He was actually a really nice kid, but he had that look in his eye every once in a while of mischief. I hope this is not portending anything harmful for anyone. So he ended up a good kid.
Was Blade always trying to ice skate uphill, Josh? I'm sorry, that's a deep cut.
I don't know what it's been so long. He was a good kid, though. He was a nice guy. He ended up being a good kid.
Once again, Les must like chastise as a word, because haven't we heard the faint little...
it was in Blaylene.
Like goblin Les voices. Chastise.
That's right. That's my favorite thing from that track. Chastise. That's right. You have to say it. You have to say it like Gilbert Gottfried. And it works out great. You're absolutely right. I think he likes that word, but it just fits so well here. Plus, this idea of corporal punishment has really fallen out of favor, especially in the last 30 years. Now, I don't know about you guys. I got spanked a few times when I was a kid. I don't have any physical or psychological damage as a result, but this is certainly an antiquated idea. But it is one of those things where you used to beat your kids if they didn't behave. You know, some people still do it, unfortunately, and we know that it doesn't actually get the results that you want. But this kid is an interesting case because he's not showing remorse for his actions, and that's the disturbing part. I don't know what's at play here, mental illness or just straight criminal tendencies. If the kid is just attention seeking because dad's neglecting him, and therefore perpetuating the cycle of abuse, we're going to a dark place. I'm going to stop talking. Frankie, please jump in.
One day, old Renegades knock into the Park Theater downtown. For a laugh, he set fire to the screen, burned the whole damn place to the ground. That's my favorite part of the song. I love those lyrics.
arson, Frankie? Do you have a fascination with fire?
No, I mean, it's just, it's really amazing, you know, the turn that he makes, you know, from introducing the character, you know, by saying, okay, so his pop named him Renegade. He lived up to his name with all the trouble that he made. I mean, what kind of things come to your mind? You know, maybe, you know, he's pulling the typical pranks kids of his age would do. But then suddenly they're telling you about this kid who burned a cinema to the ground, yes, or a theater. Jeez.
Arson. I mean, it's Grand Theft Auto. Yeah. He's going
really,
he's going
unexpected.
I really think spanking him is not the answer, Dad. I think the thing that really comes back around on this is the themes around, the lyrical themes around this album of these unsavory characters. And here's another couple of unsavory people. Yeah, it's just kind of icky, but the music is awesome. So I'm unsettled and I'm concerned for these people. At the same time, I'm rocking out. Maybe that's what they were going for. Today's 1897 Connection, guys, is actually in the form of a Final Jeopardy question. In 1897, she was accused of a much lesser crime, shoplifting in Rhode Island. 30 seconds. Frankie, you're going to kick yourself if you don't get this one.
Frankie is Googling. I call shenanigans.
You'll find it. You're going to find it if you Google it. That's cheating.
I'm going to guess, I don't know if this is the right time period, but I'm going to guess Bonnie, she of Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, good guess, but not correct. Ready?
Yeah.
Lizzie Borden.
Oh, no. No idea.
Lizzie Borden, of course, accused of killing her dad and stepmom with an axe in 1892, was acquitted, but then 5 years later was accused of shoplifting.
Wow.
Now, a lot of people forget that Lizzie Borden was actually in her 30s when she was accused of doing this. A lot of people think she was a kid. Well, let's go back to your favorite part, Frankie, of the burning the cinema to the ground. In 1897, there was also a fire in Windsor, Nova Scotia, which burned 80% of the town down.
Wow.
Maybe Renegade got around.
Could be.
Any last thoughts on this track, guys? Pretty darn satisfying. Listen, I gotta say.
Incredible song. Wish they had played it live more often. Wish they had brought it back for later tours. It's just incredible musicianship all around from all three involved. Really addictive guitar parts, very satisfying bass. And, you know, as Matt said, you know, he said something that I completely agree with at the beginning. The Renegades at the end kind of outstay their welcome a little bit, but it's all worth it, you know, for the solo. It's so satisfying that, I mean, we can let it go.
To that point, is it the chant that you're not a big fan of that are not printed in the lyric book, or is it the vocal delivery on the creaky, cranky Renegade?
The last buildup.
I will say I do appreciate that part, because the vocal chant and the Renegade, they both end in unison with a "Come here, boy," which is really important. Looks like we have some live tracks to consider, Frankie.
Okay, Josh. The first one is May 26, 1998, Toulouse, France, at the Bikini. I absolutely love the name of that venue, Bikini. Seriously, how many venues are called that way? I mean, that's pretty unique.
I think that term predates, of course, the item of clothing. So it's something else. You know, it's in reference to something else. But I could be wrong. All right, so here's a couple portions of Renegade. I'm going to play the timestamps that Frankie instructed me to. Pushing that tempo. He's kind of doing, I think Brain's doing that double cymbal hit that Soya loves so much too in there.
For a track like this, if you're going to play it live, it doesn't strike me, like if you're putting together a live set list, live shows are high energy environments, you're going to be playing your Jerry's, your Muds. It's not one of those tracks that jumps out at you like, oh, this is going to like really go over live. But Primus also has made a lot of tracks that I wouldn't think go over super energetically or awesomely live really translate. So I think maybe pushing that tempo just a little bit, and especially I think that riff probably goes a long way to carry it in a live environment, because it kind of really builds up to that riff, and that's where kind of a lot of the energy gets let out. That's a cool. It's not a soundboard, which I'm sure Soya would love, but it does have that recording has a really good chunky sound.
It sure does, and I'm gonna play one more part from it at Frankie's request. That part. There you go, man. Oh, I think Lur just missed it on that transition. Oh, man.
Fantastic brain fills, right?
Those fills are massive. I'm a big fan of those.
Brain is killing it there. That thing that Soy always mentions about how precise and fast of a right kick drum foot that Brain has to just, I mean, it's really... A lot of drummers can play, you know, really fast succession kick drum, but Brain does it with a level of precision to where it always sounds like he's hitting with the same level of intensity, and yes, like every note pops. And that fill, when he did that, just like popped in such a pleasing way. That was awesome.
At the Phoenix Theater, another fantastic rendition of Renegade.
Isn't this the night they record a Videoplasty?
Videoplasty, okay. Taping. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay,
great. Nice.
Well, this didn't make Videoplasty, but let's hear a portion of Renegade. Struggled with that. Nope. How'd I guess? That's cool. Yep. Good choice, Frankie.
Thanks.
I like that part. Brain actually, it's funny because he held back on the first one, and then the second one he gave us a little bit at least.
I love when Brain lays into the China cymbal too. He got a couple nice, really good China hits in that. It's always fun to hear because the Primus drummers, they always sort of, a lot of drummers, but in Primus, it's fun to hear how the drummers sort of interpret their own material in a live setting and kind of do little flourishes and change things up here and there. There seems to be a lot of improvisation going on with Brain in terms of his fills and a lot of that stuff. And I'm sure Soya would say it's because Brain didn't have a lot of time to prepare in the studio, so he just kind of winged it. Yeah. So it's still fairly unformed and nothing set in stone yet. So there's a lot of room to kind of play around with it and interpret it.
Yeah, refining it as he goes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of this one at Frankie's timestamp.
Oh, how weird. It's the riff again.
You know, I was trying to listen to Larry there, but I just keep going back to Brain because he's
pushing. The feels are out of this world.
How would you like to play with a drummer like that, Matt?
Oh, that would be amazing, except for the times when he was playing, when he plays way, way fast. But at least he's very, when he locks into a tempo, it is very, very consistent. Like, he doesn't speed up and slow down mid-song.
Right.
His tempos are, like, locked in, but
yeah,
sometimes that speed can really add to the energy, and sometimes it's like, hey, pull it back
down
a little bit.
Yep, bring it down, dude. Well, I get to say this, I suppose. Renegade, come here, boy. You've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, I'm going to ask you and everybody out there to remember this day.
Forever, Josh.
Forever, yeah. that's because we're going to be listening to Arnie next time, Frankie. You might recognize that tune. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us and helping us out with the music today. Appreciate it as always.
Always a pleasure.
Soya will be back next week to help us wrap up the Brown Album, folks. It's been quite a ride. Looking forward to wrapping it up with Arnie next week. Once again, find us at Instagram and Twitter at Primus Tracks, PrimusTracksPod@gmail.com, and Frankie's Facebook page O-Rama, over which I have no control and it makes me very nervous. So be careful.
Yes, the community is growing quite a bit. Please follow Primus Tracks on Facebook.
Later days.
Willie Mays.
Chastise.